Hi, I'm Shirley, and thank you for joining us today on our Genetic Society podcast. So today's podcast, we'll be looking at model organisms. What are they? For those listeners who are not aware of model organisms, well, these are animals and plants that we use commonly for research. Today, we'll be discovering, first of all, what are the supermodels in our backyards? Second, why tobacco isn't all that bad? And third, how you can learn to love liverworts. So I guess being a dietitian, I've always just worked with humans in clinical trials until I discovered in these three-day workshops and meeting all these fellow genetic experts that actually there's a whole wide range of organisms that we can work with in research. So to start off with, we're going to go and head outside for a model organism safari with Harriet.
I'm outside Chichley Hall with fellow researchers Jeremy and Jenny, who are assuring me that we are in fact surrounded by scientific model organisms. So I've always thought of model organisms as species that are commonly used in biological research as they're easy to work with, and then you apply these findings to less accessible organisms of interest. Jeremy, would you say this is the case?
Exactly, Harriet. So the organism I'm actually interested in understanding are the first land plants that ever existed. And these are completely inaccessible because they're extinct. So the organism I'm using to try and understand these is a plant called a liverwort. And the reason I use it is because it's our best guess at what these plants were like. So if I look at the genes in the liverwort and how they control how it grows, we can start to point towards how the first land plants might have been growing.
So I've never heard of a liverwort. What is it?
They're really common in the UK, actually, although not very commonly used in biological research at the moment. And in fact, if you look at the bottom of this wall on our left-hand side, you can see these curly, fleshy, green things.
Those things that look like moss?
They really do look quite like moss, don't they? But they're in fact a slightly more ancient, very separate group of plants.
So can you use these in your experiments?
Unfortunately not, because I need to do my experiments in sterile conditions and also make sure my plants are all the same. So the plants I work with were brought here from Japan.
So organisms used as models have to be highly controlled in a lab. Is this true, Jenny?
Well, I think most people think of model organisms as those you'd find in a lab. But in fact, advances in technology mean we can begin to study the genetics of a few select wild animal populations.
So is your organism out here, Jenny?
So as you can hear, we're surrounded by birds, and that's what I'm studying. A population of great tits, not here, but in Whiteham Woods in Oxford. This is an intensively studied population. It's been studied for more than 50 years, providing an ideal model system for studying the genetics of behaviour, particularly whether they can adapt their behaviour to a changing climate.
So a model organism needs to be highly controlled so you can pinpoint exactly what you're looking at, yes?
Exactly. So when I do experiments, I need there to be as few differences between my plants as possible.
But some may say that doesn't reflect the real world.
Well, I think to understand natural systems, you have to study wild animals, and that's the big advantage of this population of great tits. They're completely wild and completely free to roam.
Well, thanks, guys. So it seems model organisms aren't always what you think of as mice in labs. It turns out there's actually a lot more to be discovered in your back garden.
Thank you, Harriet, for going outside and discovering something new in our backyard. And I thank you to Jeremy and Jenny, who were outside with her. So back in the studio, we have here Frank, Alberto and Lynn, who are also researchers, and we're going to learn a bit more about the model organisms that they use for their research. So I guess, you know, most people are quite familiar with the use of mice as a common model organism. And we have here Frank, who also works with mice. So can you tell us a little bit about what are you doing with them?
Yeah, hello. By using mice, people have learned a lot about mice themselves, other animals, and of course humans. But there's so much more we can learn from mice.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about
that. Yeah, so for example, we look at modifications of mitochondrial DNA. And mitochondrial DNA are small molecules within cellular factories within the cell. And within these factories, the energy is produced from the food
right.
A mouse or a human intakes.
So what does this actually mean for us in terms of research, any applications?
Well, we want to understand the basic biological principle that is fundamental for all animals who have mitochondria.
Right.
And we are interested in small, subtle changes to the DNA and not interested in changes of the DNA sequence itself.
Ah.
And these changes are called DNA methylation and are very important to switch genes on and off.
Okay. Right, so that's interesting. I guess I can see, you know, why we need to use model organisms like mice, because physiologically they're very similar to humans, and we can't... But can we use them? Can't we just use humans to study DNA methylation?
Yes, we could, but in our case, we are very interested in tissues with high energy demand, and such a tissue is, for example, brain.
Yeah.
Which is hard to access for humans. So that's why mouse is, in our case, a better model organism and the better animal to work with.
Okay, right. That's very fascinating. I guess looking at this from another point of view, we also have Alberto, who works with a different model organism, that being fish. So I can see from Frank what he said, that model organisms like mice are important and they're similar to humans. But fish, they're so evolutionarily distant to humans. Why did you choose to work with them?
That's right. I'm working with zebrafish, and although it seems that it's very different to human, around 70% of their genes are quite similar to ours. So we can really study the basic process in zebrafish and transport and translate this information to how humans could work.
Okay, so it can relate to humans.
Yeah,
in
my lab, what we are understanding is how melanocytes, that are the pigment cells that give color to our skin, how they develop. So I'm especially interested in understanding the genes that guide this development from the first cells in the embryo, just after fertilization, to become pigment cells. And for that, zebrafish is really useful because their embryos are developing eggs outside the parent's body, so we can really see how they develop since time one after fertilization. And also, the embryos are transparent, so that allows us to see the development of the pigment cells without interfering with the normal development of the fish.
Right, so you aren't actually doing anything to induce anything, but actually observing them in their natural habitat. That's very interesting. But then how can you actually apply what you learn from using zebrafish?
So understanding how these genes that drive melanocyte development in fish will help us to understand what happens when these genes are not working properly. And in that way, they induce skin cancer that is known as melanoma. And this cancer is one of the most aggressive and most with high death rates. So it will be really interesting to know how these genes work to develop further treatments and drugs in the future for this cancer.
That's an interesting way to look at it. We've never thought about maybe fish, do they get sunburned and get skin cancer too?
Indeed, they can.
Okay. So last of all, we have Lynn. And Lynn, you study a very unusual model organism. It's not something that we normally consider when we think about research. I mean, Lynn looks at tobacco plants. And I guess most of us would think of tobacco plants in terms of public health campaigns. You know, we're always told that smoking is not good for us. We're told that it leads to cancer and cardiovascular disease. So, Lynn, your lab has actually altered our view of tobacco plants, and they're actually maybe beneficial to society. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Thank you, Shirley. Yeah, tobacco has had a bit of an image problem, I think. The general public tends to think about cigarettes and smoking when they think about tobacco. But I want to try and convince you that it's actually a really important tool for plant research.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, tobacco has been used for a lot of basic genetic research.
Like what?
Well, we use it because it's actually really easy to put DNA from a different plant into tobacco.
Right.
So this makes it a really good tool for studying how genes function.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to apply this to my research in floral diversity. So not only is tobacco really easy to genetically engineer, but the family has got a really wide variety of very beautiful flowers.
Oh, so should we all be buying some more tobacco plants and putting them in our backyards later on?
Well, they are actually very important horticulturally, and you've probably got a lot of them in the garden.
Oh, wow.
But for my own research, I like to study plant-pollinator interactions.
Okay.
So this makes it a really good family for this point of view as well.
Mm.
Well, I suppose apart from being interesting to study the evolution of flowers, we can also apply this to the food crops that we eat. So a lot of the crops that we eat rely on natural pollinator communities for pollination. And a lot of these communities are in decline at the moment. So perhaps my research might be able to contribute to, in the future, making sure that we maximise food production from these crops.
So I guess what I'm gathering is tobacco could possibly help us resolve some food security issues.
Hopefully.
That's great. Well, I guess this is all very fascinating for me, and I've learnt so much about model organisms. Just one thing that's still troubling me is, you know, I've always been hesitant about using model organisms because, like, I've had a pet before, and I know that I'll get so emotionally attached with organism that I'll work with. You feed them every day, you look after them, you know, you water your flowers and your plants. How do you, what is it like working with them personally, and how do you deal with some of these emotional bonds that you might form with them? So, Frank, what about you?
Yeah, well, I'm a bioinformatician, and I'm working on the computer, and I'm never based in the lab, so actually I've never seen these mice we're working
what?
On.
What? Really?
Yeah, so, but I do love them, because without them, I probably won't have the job I have now.
That's true. Interesting. So, Jeremy, what about you?
So I've actually had a very different experience, because one of the reasons I chose my PhD project was because I'd be working with liverworts. And although the main reason for that is the questions they allow me to answer, I also quite enjoy growing them, and they've been described by one of my colleagues as cute in the same way as an ugly dog. But it can be frustrating working with such a little-known organism, because when I tell people about them, originally they always think that I'm working with a liver disease or something.
Yeah, I kind of thought that when I heard the name too. What about Alberto? What are your experiences?
So, as you said, they are really nice, like pets and fish are really nice to work with, but at the same time, they are animals, so they do what they want, and sometimes you need them for an experiment and they don't want to cooperate, so you have to just wait for them to do what they want.
It can get a bit frustrating.
Yeah, it can be frustrating sometimes.
And Jenny, who work with wild animals, what's that like?
Well, I'm really thrilled to be working with a system where we're gaining some insight into genetics and adaptation in the wild. But I'd have to agree with Alberto about the complications, because my subjects can always just fly away. One of the things I've found is that if you want to reach out to the non-scientific community, introducing yourself as someone that studies great tits is a real good way to grab attention.
That's very true. And Lynn, what about you?
Well, I do enjoy working with tobacco, and it's really nice to see all the different floral forms and what they look like. But I have found it to be very sticky. So
sticky?
Yes, actually.
Why are they sticky?
I'm not sure why, but the leaves tend to... they're very sticky and they stick to your clothes. You're trying to take seeds from them, you're trying to take samples. It can be really annoying. So
can you wash them off? Is it something that you can easily dry clean with? Or?
I think the answer is to wear gloves and wear a lab coat.
Right, good answer. Well, thank you guys for your brilliant contribution to this radio podcast. I've learnt so much about model organisms that I don't think I would have otherwise. And basically, it has just completely changed my views of working with model organisms. I mean, thank you, Harriet, for bringing about Jenny and Jeremy, and to reveal to us that really model organisms aren't just about working in the lab and about lab mice or things like that. And I really thank the scientists who have come into the studio today, Frank, Alberto, and Lynn. Really, Lynn, seriously, next time I look at a packet of cigarettes, I'm going to be astounded, and I don't think I'll ever be able to look at that the same way again. So thank you all so much for contributing today, and we hope that you will tune in to our station next time.